turn to the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel for our lesson today. This particular section of the book of Daniel is not an easy section to teach. It really is world history in outline. It's not so much a prophecy as it is just an actual record of what took place. Now, when it was uttered, it was a prophecy because it had not come to pass. But as we look back on it today, it's nothing more than a historical record of what has already transpired during the time of Daniel, all the way down to the end is covered here in this 11th chapter. Because of the detailed account we have here of the rise and fall of various kings and nations, the critics of the book of Daniel have said that this couldn't have possibly been written in 533 B.C. Nobody could have known all the details of the battles and every little thing that's described here. But again, they're failing to realize that the Bible is inspired by the Holy Spirit of God, that the prophecies that we have in the Bible are history written in advance. I wonder if we don't make a statement that's wrong sometime. We say that history unveils prophecy. Is that true, or should we put it like this? Prophecy foretells history. It's really true either way. But what we're seeing here in the 11th chapter of Daniel is one of the most detailed descriptions of what would happen in various kingdoms as to the kings that would rule and reign and what would happen during their time, until it almost defies imagination to believe that Daniel could be inspired of God to give all these great details as he did. But it is remarkable. And while it's already happened now and we look back on it, when you think about the fact that it was written before any of it happened, then the prophecy certainly does attest the absolute foreknowledge of God, his ability to know beforehand what's going to happen in the earth. Well, look at some of these introductory remarks here in the lesson. The 11th chapter of Daniel gives a history of the world in its relation to Israel from Darius to the time of the end, or until Jesus comes back to set up the kingdom. Verses 2 to 35 deal especially with the wars of the Ptolemies and the Seleucid kings. The Ptolemies ruled Egypt, and that kingdom lay south of Palestine. And then you had the king of the north, which was the Seleucid kings. So the Ptolemies ruled Egypt, and in the main they were Egyptians as to their nationality. The Seleucid kings in the main were Greeks, and they ruled in the country called Syria. Now, these people played ball with the land of Palestine for hundreds of years. If you'll visualize on the map, to the north of Palestine, you have Syria. The situation is still pretty much the same today. You have the Syrian rule. Of course, you got Lebanon up there too now, which did not exist in that time. But you still have Syria to the north of Palestine in a very contemporary scene. You still have Egypt to the south of Palestine, very much like it was there in the days of Daniel the prophet. And there is still a problem there between Syria, Palestine, and Egypt. So I don't know whether the world's changed very much or not since the days of Daniel. But the problem is that Palestine is a battleground. It's a battleground between the king of the north and the king of the south. So they more or less play football with it, is what I'm telling you. So the battlefield is Palestine. They didn't fight so much always in their own country, their own territory. They used Palestine as a battlefield because that land was between the king of the north and the king of the south. And so that's what made it tough on Daniel's people, you see. Sometimes the Jews were under the domination of, shall we say, the king of the north, the Syrians, the Seleucid kings. And at other times, they were under the domination of Egypt, the king of the south. And so you could hardly tell from one time to another just exactly who was ruling the land of Palestine. Because as soon as one gained the ascendancy, then the other nation would come back and retaliate. The battlefield again would be Palestine. So that's why there were so many wars in Jerusalem, because it was a battlefield between Egypt and Assyria, two very old nations in the world. It is still the battlefield today. The world has not changed very much. Now verses 2 to 5, 35 of Daniel chapter 11 are very significant in that they deal with what we call the interbiblical period, the time between the Old Testament and the New Testament, or sometimes, as it's called by scholars, the 400 silent years. But really, it's not silent years because there is a predictive prophecy here of what would happen during the 400 silent years. Not all the details, but at least some of the things that would happen to Daniel's people, the Israelites, during this time. Now, really, to understand all this, we need to almost go get a book on world history and read along by the side, which we will not have time to do, and I've only briefly related the affairs of history here that you might understand what these verses mean. Now, when we get down to verse 36, we have a description then of the Antichrist, the man of sin, and all of these other wicked rulers were forerunners of him. But now let's start. We have the beginning of the vision, the timetable there in verse 1. And then verse 2 tells us about some important kings that will rule in Media and Persia. Also I, in the first year of Darius the Mede. Daniel is either in his late 80s or early 90s at this time. Even I stood to confirm and to strengthen him. And now will I show thee the truth. You remember how that the angel had said back in the latter part of this 10th chapter in verse 21, but I will show thee that noted in the scripture of truth. The scripture of truth in that case was God's decrees concerning the rise and fall of kingdoms. Did not necessarily refer to the Bible, though it was a part of the Bible, as this 11th chapter is a part of the Bible, you see. And now I will show thee the truth. Bear in mind now that the angel is still telling Daniel about what's going to happen to his people for, to use the term out of the Bible, the many days to come upon them. The many days. It is many days because it will run a period of better than 2,000 years. As a matter of fact, it will run at least almost 2,500 years altogether. So it certainly does concern what will happen to Daniel's people in the many days to come. And so he begins to relate some of that. And now I will show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia. We have Darius the Mede on the throne at this time. Three others to come after him, he said. And the fourth shall be far richer than they all. The fourth king would be very wealthy. And by his strength, military strength as well as money, and by his strength through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. So this particular fourth king that he speaks of will be a bitter enemy of the Grecian people and will invade Greece. He'll rise up against them. He'll bring all of his forces together and attack them. So now, this is a revelation of the future of the Medo-Persian Empire. And in addition to Cyrus and Darius that are reigning at this particular time, it was a combined kingdom. You had Cyrus ruling in Persia, you had Darius ruling in Media. So I'm saying that these kings are in addition to Cyrus and Darius that now reign. It is thought by scholars that the three kings of Persia would be Cambyses. He ruled from 529 to 522 B.C. That the other was Pseudo-Semiradus, who reigned from 522 to 521 B.C. He was a usurper and did not reign very long, as you'll note from the chronology there. They overthrew him because he was not a rightful king. And then, of course, Darius the First, Histopes, who reigned from 521 to 486 B.C. Please bear in mind that there are more than one Cyrus, there's more than one Darius. There's more than one Seleucid king. There's more than one Ptolemy. There's more than one Caesars. And this is the way that it is. So that's why we sometimes say Darius the First, Darius the Great, and so on, in order to distinguish these various ones in history. Now these kings, if I remember in the Bible, are called Artaxerxes, Ahasuerus, and of course Darius is still called Darius, if I remember. So in the Bible, they're not, this is the historical names that I've given, like Cambyses and Pseudo-Semiramis. They were called Artaxerxes and Ahasuerus and other names there in the Bible. But I gave them the name that they have there in history. Now the fourth king was none other than Xerxes the First. Very prominent, very wise, and domineering king of a sort. And this is the one that's called Ahasuerus in the book of Esther. Now let me correct something. It was not Ahasuerus back up there before. It's hard to keep these straight. The Xerxes, the fourth king, is Ahasuerus in the book of Esther. Now his invasion of Greece in about 480 ended in disaster. It looked like at first that he was going to do quite a job in overthrowing the kingdom of Grecia. But he underestimated the ability and power of the Grecian people, because in the end, he didn't do so well. He didn't do so well at all. And he spent 4 years gathering an army of 2,641,000 people, and he had 150 ships. With all of his riches and all of his might and all of his military ingenuity, he attacked the Grecian people, but did not have very much success. He was defeated. And of course, did not overcome the kingdom of Grecia as he had expected. Now, I don't know why, but about 150 years had just passed over there in silence. Nothing is said here in the book of Daniel. There's really a gap there of about 150 years between verse 1 and 2. When you go down to verse 3 and 4, you're already into the time of Alexander the Great. You've already passed out of the Medo-Persian worldwide empire into the Grecian worldwide empire. You say, well, why did God leave that out? I don't know. Don't ask me. I can't answer that. I'll never know until he tells me why. And a mighty king shall stand up, and that, of course, is none other than Alexander the Great, and shall rule with great dominion. We've already pointed out how that the he-goat, Alexander, was certainly one of the great world rulers of all times. In about 12 years, he conquered the known world. And this is none other than Alexander, the son of Philip of Macedon, who conquered all of Asia in something like 12 years, from 336 to 323 B.C. And so that is certainly the reference there is to Alexander, as we're going to see. And that will rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven. And not to his posterity, that is, not to any son or daughter, nor according to his dominion which he rules. In other words, Greece will no longer rule all these other kingdoms. For his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others beside those. Now that is a fourfold division in the Grecian Empire upon the death of Alexander the Great. We have pointed this out before, and we'll reaffirm it again here this morning. You had Cassander, who took Macedonia and the western part. Lysimachus took Thrace and the northern part. And Seleucus took Syria and the eastern part. Now remember that Syrian division there. That eastern division will be the one that will be north of Palestine. And then the one that will be south comes next. Ptolemy took Egypt and the southern part. These men were all four generals in the army of Alexander. And when he died, the kingdom was more or less peacefully divided among these four great generals that had stood with him in the 12-year wars and campaigns that had raged there throughout the various parts of Europe, as well as Africa, Palestine, and other places there in the world. So that was a rather peaceful division in the Grecian kingdom. There were some minor wars, but not anything of any major proportion. So Daniel has foretold all of this ahead of time. Alexander would not have any successor, no son, no daughter would take over the kingdom. It would rather be divided among his four generals. And as it was written by the prophet, even so it happened in the world. History fulfilled prophecy. prophecy predicted what history would do. Now, we've already seen that in an earlier chapter, but now we're going to see some of the wars between this eastern kingdom and southern kingdom that primarily is commanded by at least two generals of Alexander at the beginning. And, of course, later other men will come on the scene. All right, let's go on now and read verse 5 that tells about Ptolemy the first Soter and Seleucus the first Nicator. And the king of the south shall be strong. Now, what's the king of the south? It's Egypt. It's the kingdom that lays south of Palestine. It's Egypt. Very ancient kingdom, still exists today. And the king of the south shall be strong. And one of his princes. And he shall be strong above him. That is, the prince there that's spoken of will surpass the king of Egypt. And his dominion shall be a great dominion. Well, now the prophecy has now narrowed down to two of these four kingdoms that were mentioned earlier. And Palestine is between Syria and Egypt. Not necessarily a part of either one, but oftentimes conquered by either one. Okay, the king of the south here is Ptolemy the First Soter. He ruled from 323 to 285 B.C. Now, the one stronger than him is Seleucus the First Nicator, who ruled from 412 to 281. I think that's 381. I think that 2 needs to be a 3 there, B.C. You might change that with your pen. Now, this is a rather odd thing that happened there. I'm going to try to relate that from my notes as well as my memory. For a time, this prince yoked up with Ptolemy. In other words, he was a friend to him, an ally. But as he got stronger and stronger, the situation began to change some. Now, at first, they combined their strength to defeat Antigonus. And, of course, that paved the way for Seleucus to gain control of the entire area from Asia Minor to India. Which means there that that prince became greater than the king of the south, who was Ptolemy. So his ally gained the ascendancy over him and ruled there all the way from Asia Minor to India, which was a lot of the known world of that time. And so while these kings now have been allies for a time, when the prince becomes greater than the king, what happens? He begins to make war on his ally. And so the tables turn and the old friend becomes the new enemy. And that's what is taking place there. In other words, what's happening here, the king of Syria has become great and he's going to attack the king of the north. Whereas for a time, they went together against this one king there. So now they become rivals and the battle is going to rage and rage for hundreds of years after that. And then we go on down to verse 6 and we find the marriage of the daughter of Egypt to the king of Syria. That was strictly a military compact to make peace between the two nations, as was oftentimes the case in history. So now let's look at that sixth verse. And in the end of years, that means that quite a period of time really elapsed there, they shall join themselves together. Now they've been allies, they get to be enemies, and now they're allies again. But how do they get to be allies? Well, one of them's daughter will marry the other king, you see, and that locks the families together in matrimony. And in the end of years, they shall join themselves together. That is, they'll be two united kingdoms. For the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north. So we know that simply means that the daughter there of the king of Egypt will marry the king of Syria. To make an agreement. Well, marriage is a covenant or an agreement. So they're going to get married is the idea. But she shall not retain the power of the arm when her husband dies, you see. Neither shall he stand. The king will die, nor his arm. His power will diminish. But she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. A lot of peculiar things described there. Let's see now if we can elaborate here and give some names from history as to what's happening. Here is the intermarriage of the daughter of Egypt with the king of Syria, strictly for military purposes. There's no doubt about it. It is strictly for political reasons. Not necessarily any love between them. It's a political compact. Now the participants were Ptolemy II, Philadelphus, and his daughter, Bernice, married Antiochus II, Theus. And they did that in about 252 B.C. You can see that quite a number of years are involved here between the events. We're coming all the way down during this 400 years, 500 years almost. Now, Bernice could not retain the political power. In other words, you see, her daddy said, you go up there and you kind of ramrod the king of Assyria and keep everything going in our favor. But it didn't work out that way. What Ptolemy thought would take place, it seemed like it just about the reverse happened. And didn't turn out well for him at all. And so she was not able to retain that political power to keep Egypt on good standing with Syria. That's what her father had hoped for. First of all, Ptolemy died. Her husband died. That's what it meant there about he shall not stand. In other words, he'll die. He passed from the scene. And so, not her husband, but her father dies. And so that good standing there that existed between the king of the north and the king of the south is not any good because the king of the south is dead. But his daughter's still up there as the wife of the king of the north, the king of Syria. So then Antiochus took back his first wife, Laodice. And he had to divorce her in order to marry the daughter there of Ptolemy. There's quite an ordeal about that. And, of course, he doesn't have any reason now to stay with Bernice, so he divorces her and he goes back to his first wife, Laodice. And this is the situation that existed there. So then Laodice has some political aspirations of her own, and she poisoned her husband. She killed him. Was it vengeance because he divorced her? Probably, if I had to guess. And so then she don't want Bernice to live very long because she's a rival. And it might be that friends of Bernice will take over the kingdom and will have her thrown out of the country. So what does she do? She has Bernice assassinated. Bernice has a child by Antiochus, and she has a child killed. He's a rival too, you see. And then her friends are all destroyed. Anybody that would have lined up there with Bernice, they're put to death. Now, when you read this, just think about how many times in the history of the world that's happened. Have you ever read about the kings of Germany and the kings of England and even the kings like Herod and all of those that reigned in Palestine? It's just a history of one killing the other and one right after the other. Well, you have pretty much the same thing going on today. One politician can't wait to devour the other and get him out of office, sometime even assassinate him. If you want to know what really was behind a lot of the assassination of our presidents, it was probably somebody else wanting their job. You say, well, that couldn't happen in this country. I think it did in the case of John F. Kennedy in my lifetime. I think Lyndon Johnson had him killed so he could get the job. He was the vice president and he would get the job. He did. He was elected then as a Democratic president for 4 years after that. So there are a lot of things like that happen. The history of the world is written in blood. Kings and politicians, they swim to the throne in valleys of blood and dirty, crooked politics as well. And here is brought out some of the things that go on in nations. It's dirty, dirty history. It's not pleasant, but that's the way that the world has been going on for hundreds of years and no doubt will continue for many years to come. Well, let's go along. We want to try to get down to about verse 20 because we want to get through most of this history. We're going to go now from verse 7 down to verse 9. But out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate. That would mean a relative of hers. Which shall come with an army and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north. That is, this relative of hers will attack Syria. And shall deal against them and shall prevail. Take vengeance. And shall also carry away captives into Egypt, their gods, with their princes, and with their precious vessels of silver and of gold. And he shall continue more years than the king of the north. That is, his kingdom will endure longer. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom, and shall return to his own land. All right, let's see if we can fill in here from history what's predicted in that. Ptolemy Euergetes, who reigned from 246 to 221 B.C., was a brother of Bernice. And he marched to Syria and took revenge for putting Laodice to death and capturing Seleucia. So in other words, he went up there and made amends for the way they treated his sister. He took vengeance on them. But he had an insurrection that broke out in Egypt. In other words, there's trouble at home, so he has to leave and go back. But he didn't go empty-handed. Ptolemy, on his return, took 4,000 talents of silver, 2,500 precious vessels and idol gods, and many princes, just as Daniel said in his book. So Lucius Callinicus attacked Egypt about 240 B.C. and was defeated and returned to Syria. All of that too predicted there in Daniel's verses. Now we're going to take in quite a section here. We're going to go all the way from about verse 10 all the way down to verse 19. And this is again some great details of battle. But his sons shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces. And one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up even to his fortress. And the king of the south shall be moved with choler, and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north. And he shall send forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. And when he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up. And he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. For the king of the north shall return and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves. Now the robbers of Daniel's people would be Jews, to establish the vision, but they shall fall, that is, get themselves killed. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities. And the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people. Neither shall there be any strength to withstand. And he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will. And none shall stand before him. He shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her. But she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. Which simply means that man's daughter will turn against him. After this shall he turn his face unto the isle, the islands of the sea, and shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Well, we've got a lot of history here. We're going to try to fill it in as best we can, because this is a struggle between Seleucus and Antiochus III, usually called Antiochus the Great, against Ptolemy Philopater. And so let's see now. We have these ordeals taking place. Let's take it as we have it listed here. The sons of Seleucus Callinicus, Seleucus Saramus, and Antiochus the Great both assembled their large armies. Seleucus Saramanus succeeded his father, but was unsuccessful against Egypt during the reign of 2 to 3 years that he was on the throne. Antiochus the Great invaded Egypt successfully. He seized Tyre and Ptolemais, passing through Palestine, and marched against Gaza, the fortress of the kingdom of the south, mentioned there in verse 10. That was about 218 B.C. Ptolemy Philopater was aroused by the invasion and defeated Antiochus at Riphah in 217 B.C. Philopater's heart was lifted up by his success, and he returned to Egypt for pleasure. In other words, he wanted to go home and celebrate the victory. He did not go on to conquer the king of the north, which was a tragic mistake in his case. While he had the man on the run, he should have defeated him. But he was content with a minor conquest, and therefore went back home to enjoy his conquest, which ended up being disaster for him. After 13 years of peace, Antiochus marched against Ptolemy Epiphanes, the infant son of Ptolemy Philopater. Now, one of the many who stood up against the infant king was Philip, king of Macedon, who agreed to divide the kingdom of Egypt with Antiochus. To the victor belongs the spoils. That was the idea there. The robbers were Jews who Antiochus finally turned against. In other words, as oftentimes the case has been with Jews, they'll line up with their enemies, hoping to have some advantage when they take over the kingdom. But whenever the kingdom's taken over, then they're exterminated. And that has happened more than one time. If you don't believe that, let me give you a little history right here about the overthrow of the Bolsheviks in Russia. Do you know who one of the leading men in that movement was? Leon Trotsky. You know who Leon Trotsky was? He was a Jew. You know who the founder of communism was? He's Karl Marx. He was a Jew too. Not anything real bad happened to Karl Marx, but Leon Trotsky was executed, though he was one of the prominent men in the beginning of communism in Russia. He was killed because he was a Jew. And so they got rid of other Jews after that, though these Jews had helped, is what I'm pointing out. And every time that they would liquidate one of them, they called him a Trotskyite. A Trotskyite. And so it's oftentimes the case that whenever the Jews yoke up with their enemies, hoping to have some political advantage, it turns out to their disadvantage. The only advantage they could ever have is to crown Jesus Christ their king. Until they do that, they're going to have trouble in this world, just like they're having here already, because they'd gone into idolatry, setting the stage for their rejection of the king. And then down in verses 15 to 16, the king of the south did not withstand Antiochus, who subjected the whole land of Palestine. He conquered it. He took it over. And then due to Roman aid, Antiochus was forced to offer his daughter, Cleopatra, to Ptolemy Epiphanes. And Cleopatra was only 7 years old at that time, just a very young girl, I'd say. Cleopatra is called there the daughter of a woman. You say, well, it sounds like she didn't even have a father. No, that's not what it means. She was so young, she was still under the care of her mother and a nurse. So that's why she's stressed to be a young girl there. Just the daughter of her mother, just a little bitty girl, 7 years old to be exact. According to history, a very beautiful little girl, even at that time. She is said to be one of the most beautiful women that ever lived in the world, her and Delilah and some others like them. So here's Cleopatra. She's under the care of her mother and a nurse. They were married 5 years later when she was 12 years old, to be exact. And so now you see the idea was that this man thought his daughter would help him out. But as well established in history, she turned out to be his enemy. She didn't do him any good. She yoked up with her husband against her father. So Cleopatra turned against her father and congratulated the Romans for winning over her father. So in other words, it didn't work out too well for the Ptolemy there. The Ptolemy fellows didn't do so well, and neither did the Antiochus or any of them. It was not so good for any of them in the long run there. So Cleopatra did turn against her father and yoked up with Rome against her own people. One of the great battles of history, of course, is that, if you're familiar with it. Now, to avenge himself against the Romans, Antiochus attacked the coast of the Isles of Asia Minor with a fleet of 300 ships. He meant business. He was defeated, though, at Magnesia in about 190 B.C. by Cipriano Asiaticus, the prince that's mentioned in the prophecy there in verse 18. Antiochus returned home to make peace with his enemies. What else could he do? If you get your britches whipped off, all you can do is sue for peace, like the Japanese did at the end of the Second World War, like the Germans did, and the Italians and others. And so while making peace here with his enemies, trying to have at least a little time of peace, he ran out of money, as politicians quite often do. They run out of money for their various programs. So what did he do? He said, well, I'll go down there and I'll plunder one of these heathen temples, the Temple of Baal in Elymas. And while he went down there to get all this gold and silver, whatever may have been there, they killed him. It's a terrible thing to attack religion. Religion can become a strong force against politicians. They don't realize that. I think right now that the various politicians courting the Jewish element vote, the others trying to court the Catholic vote, and maybe some trying to get all lined up with the vast majority of the Protestant vote, the conservative vote and the like. And it's all the political winds that blow. They all go in this direction to have various groups to back them up. But whenever you attack religion, you come out openly against it, it can oftentimes be a force to overthrow the government. If you don't believe it can be, then ask what happened to the Shah of Iran. The Muslims overthrew the government because he didn't allow them to do like they wanted to. He did not allow them to practice certain aspects of their religion. And so what did they do? They got a madman, Khomeini, to overthrow the government. That's what happened. It's happened many times in the history of the world. And then, of course, there's just a brief thing there in the 20th verse. And before I go on to that, let me just make this one observation. I think we're already facing a time when our government is running out of money too. And where do you think they're going to go to get money for the taxes? To the churches, to the religious element, religious schools, religious colleges and churches. They're going to go there to get the money to operate the government on. So what happened back here in history is really going on today. You know, there's a statement in the book of Ecclesiastes, what has been shall be. And so what's happened back there? You know, reading this is almost like reading a contemporary scene of Latin American countries down south of us, or in Mexico, or maybe over in Europe someplace. It's still going on, just like it did then. People are killing one another in order to take over the world. People are mad. No wonder in this book of Daniel, the warring nations of the earth are compared to a bunch of wild beasts. That's about the way they act. That's the way God looks at them, a bunch of wild beasts. And so there's just one other episode there that follows in verse 20, and we will quickly read that. Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom. But within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. And what happened there? This man, Seleucus the IV Philopater, was the raiser of taxes spoken of. He reigned 12 years altogether. But he got to needing money, and he sent his treasurer, Heliodorus, to confiscate the treasuries of the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. And there, mysteriously, the king died of poison. And the fellow that went down there to raid the temple was killed. So what did he do? He went down there to plunder the temple, and the Jews took care of him. They didn't intend to have their temple plundered. And so this king ended up about like the other one did that tried to plunder the temple of Baal. There's just one thing for sure. You can't go around tearing down religious shrines unless you want to get into trouble. The people over in Israel would like very much today to go and construct a temple there where the Wailing Wall is and incorporate that old Wailing Wall, which is a part of the old temple there, the Herodian temple of the days of Christ, into this new temple. But why won't they do it? Because they'd have to tear down the Mosque of Omar, one of the wonders of the world that's been built by the Muslims. What do you think would happen if they tore that down? About what happened here in these two accounts. It'd be the worst war you ever saw. And so they're really afraid to do it. Now they say they're going to build it nearby. And that way they won't get into trouble, you see. So religion has a very important force. And I'm convinced that it has a greater force in our modern world than we may be inclined to think about. And so really there's nothing new. The world's still going on just like it always has been. Nations are warring and killing one another. Nothing new, really.